Today we're supposed to start working on ethers and epoxides, but given the time devoted to the quiz, we're just going to be talking about epoxides today. So as a reminder, an epoxide is a functional group that's essentially a type of ether. So it's an ether in which we have a three-membered ring, two members of which are carbon, one is an oxygen that's bridging the two. Last quarter, we learned two different methods for synthesizing epoxides. One of them was to use the reagent MCPBA. So now, where are the new students this quarter? Right here. Anybody else, I forget, this new student? Have you learned MCPBA before? Have you heard of MMPP? Because that's another reagent sometimes used. So if you didn't learn MMPP, go ahead and learn the MCPBA, because that's what everybody else had learned previously. The acronym MCPBA, that's the same reagent that I talked about in one of the problems from the final that we reviewed at the beginning of the quarter. So it stands for meta, that's what the M means. Meta chloro peroxy benzoic acid. Now, benzoic acid is benzene with a carboxylic acid group attached to it. Peroxybenzoic acid means you've got an additional oxygen. And then the meta is a position two away from where the carboxylic acid group is, and meta chloro. And I'll put in a parentheses here that we can more generally use, in theory, any peroxy acid to cause this reaction. There's only one small problem in that many, many peroxy acids are explosive, shock hazards, often where you just shake the flask and that causes it to weld. Yes. So this MCPBA is used because it is a much more stable reagent, not nearly prone to that kind of sudden decomposition. MMPP, magnesium monoperoxyphthalate. That's also one of these more stable reagents. How does this work, or how does it react? It's the oxygen-oxygen bond that's weak here, and so the oxygen furthest from the carbonyl, furthest from the carbonyl is the one that's more reactive. The oxygen directly connected to the carbonyl is going to potentially enter resonance, or it has the potential to enter resonance, which is why it is not as reactive an oxygen. So what's the mechanism for this reaction? This is what's known as a paracyclic reaction, meaning that there's going to be effectively a circle that goes on as far as transfer of electrons. And it's actually, you could say, got two circles connected to each other. Because effectively what happens is the end oxygen sits down and reacts with that double bond, forming the three-membered ring. So I'll show it the reaction occurring in this way. Let's say that the double bond does attack that oxygen. Again, because the oxygen-oxygen bond is weak. Forgot to ask this of the other two sections, but what would be the oxidation state of either of those two oxygens? -1, which is not the normal -2 oxidation state oxygen would normally want to have, and that's because of the oxygen-oxygen bond. If we were to do an analysis of this, remember that for the rules that we reviewed the other day, oxygen, when it's connected to another oxygen, we treat that bond as if it were covalent, even if we're trying to determine oxidation state. So if we look at the oxygen that is connected to a hydrogen versus an oxygen, from the hydrogen it would get both electrons, from the oxygen you would only get one electron under this counting system. So 1, 2, Another two, a total of 7 electrons, effectively, by this counting system, versus the 6 it would have if it was an unreacted oxygen. So 7 versus 6, that's why it's just got a -1 oxidation state, and therefore would like to be reduced, which happens when it gets the electrons from carbon. So, when oxygens attack, the oxygen-oxygen bond breaks, which I'm going to show swinging over and attacking the carbonyl. Because once you've broken that bond, you do have something that can undergo resonance. So by that pair of electrons attacking the carbonyl, that pushes the carbonyl open. Except, and I didn't draw it well enough for you to see this as clearly, it turns out that the hydrogen in real life is close enough that when the carbonyl opens, it can just reach out and grab that proton. Because effectively what we have is benzoate, which is a base, and then we had an acid, so it would have been acidic. Well, if it takes that hydrogen, the oxygen-hydrogen bond breaks, and that pair of electrons collapses towards the alkene to finish forming the epoxide. So you can see there's 3 arrows. The oxygen-oxygen bond breaking, the carbonyl opening, and then hydrogen being grabbed that are like it's in a circle. And then we have this other pair of arrows there as well. That's just one way of making the epoxide. Let me show you the products before I move on. Because since the alkene was planar to begin with, that means we're going to end up with potentially 2 products that would be enantiomers of each other. Now, if we had a symmetric alkene, something on that has the same groups on either side of the double bond, then we'd end up with only 1 product because we wouldn't have chirality. So that's one method. Does anybody happen to remember the other method for making an epoxide? What's that? Elimination. I think you might be thinking of alkyne. Oh, internal. Not elimination, internal substitution. Intramolecular SN2. And which functional group was it that we used to do that? You happen to remember? If not the name, can you remember what things are on it? Couldn't quite hear it. So you have a hydroxide and a halogen, right? So yes, that's a bromohydrin. So we use bromine and water, for example, to make the bromohydrin, and then you can do a deprotonation. Let me show you the example. And actually, I'm going to go ahead and throw a deuterium on here so I can better show stereochemistry. So bromine and water. The bromine goes to the less substituted position because bromine first forms a ring and then water comes and pushes it open. Water ends up attacking at the more substituted position, which we're actually going to review that in just a moment when we see reactions of epoxides. So that would push the halogen to the less substituted position. Water ends up at the more substituted position. And remember that this is an anti-addition, because again, water attacks from the opposite side of where the bromine initially ends up. And remember also that the alkene was planar, just like previously. So we can get this product, but we will also get the enantiomer. Now, this bromination reaction, if you don't remember it, you do need to go review it from last quarter. You should still be familiar with the reagent, still be familiar with the mechanism. And let me rewrite this a bit so I show a bond with oxygen, because what you would use next is something like sodium hydride, which could deprotonate that oxygen. Now, in a quiz exam, you could do exactly the same thing that I'm doing here, which is instead of having to write the structure of both enantiomers, you just need to show that you know there are enantiomers. So you can write just one product and then do as I did here, just say plus enantiomer. These groups, the oxygen and the leaving group, are now opposite of each other. Even if this had been done with a ring, a cyclic alkene, the groups would be opposite of each other, which means they would be able to get into that antiperiplanar configuration, which means you're going to have an intramolecular SN2 reaction. So any questions about synthesis of epoxides, the two different methods? Well, then let's talk about reactions of epoxides. And we're going to talk about mainly two types of reactions today. One is which that ring's going to open in a cationic method. So we're going to use an acid catalyst. Let's just start with that. Cationic, acid catalyzed. Ring opening. So a three-membered ring is definitely strained, but as you can see, it can be formed. But even though it's strained, it won't automatically fall apart necessarily. You have to sort of help it along in one way or another. I'm leaping ahead now that I've already shown you cationic. I'm going to anticipate and say that in the anionic reaction, we have something that pushes the ring open. For the cationic reaction, the reason it's called acid catalyzed is in order to encourage that ring to be more reactive, it's going to get protonated first. Now let me take one of the enantiomers from the synthesis above to show this example reaction on. We have acid catalysts. The only thing that makes sense to react first is the oxygen. Now, a question that came up in one of the sections yesterday. There's some reactions that you've learned where you have to use reversible arrows as far as their mechanism steps. There's some reactions you've learned where you just use a forward arrow for the mechanism step. Well, where do you have to worry about which one is which? In other words, how careful do you need to be that you memorize forward arrow versus reversible arrow? And the answer that I gave was this. That there will be some reactions like the protonate open attack deprotonate reaction that are clearly entirely reversible. Every step of it's reversible. And so in that case, you absolutely would need to use reversible arrows. But we're going to have something like this case where the overall reaction might not be reversible. Protonation certainly is. Anytime that you have a proton hopping on or off, that's automatically an equilibrium process. But I'm going to go ahead and use a forward arrow here because essentially the overall reaction is not really reversible. Now, a more fussy instructor, maybe for those of you who are chem majors that will be taking more organic in the future, you might have someone that would demand that you know, oh, well, since that is reversible, you use a reversible arrow. But in order to simplify our lives a little bit, I'm going to say that if we have a mechanism where you have a mix, where you have both reversible and non-reversible steps, only those reactions that are truly completely reversible are you going to be responsible for knowing that you have to use reversible arrows. So back to this, we do put a proton on. Which is going to destabilize the ring. Oh, hold on just one second. Intermediate does this look like? What reactions from last quarter does that structure look an awful lot like? Like the mercury ion, the cyclomercurinian ion that we had in oxymercuration, demercuration, what other intermediate does this look a lot like? What about the cyclobromonium ion for the bromine reaction? The reason I'm pointing this out is the logic of what happens next is exactly identical to the logic that we used last quarter to talk about which one of these bonds in this ring is going to break. Because we might look at this and say, oh, if something's going to come attack the ring, then maybe kinetics is the more important consideration. How hard is it physically for the thing that's attacking to get to the molecule? But that's not what turned out to be the case in either the bromonium or the mercurinium ion cases. In that case, we looked at the two bonds and said one of those two bonds is going to be stronger, or really what we said is one of the two bonds is going to be weaker than the other. Which is the weaker of the two bonds, the way I've written it? The one on the left or the one on the right? The left? Well, is this a primary, secondary, or tertiary position? Is deuterium a carbon? So no, this is a primary position. There's only one other carbon attached to where my finger is. Is this primary, secondary, or tertiary? Secondary. So where would a more favorable carbocation form? On a primary? On a secondary, right? There is not a carbocation that forms in this mechanism, but it might, or you can imagine it could form a carbocation. Because it turns out to be easier to form the carbocation at the secondary position, that means the bond is weaker to that position because what you'd make would be more favorable. The bond to the primary position, therefore, is stronger because it wouldn't want to break at all because you'd end up with a primary carbocation. So the bond on the left is weaker and longer because of the, no water in the lab, please, because of the potential to make a carbocation. Now, if you hadn't learned those reactions before with bromine, Br2, and then mercury acetate, they are in the notes from the previous quarter, and I recommend that you go back to them. You might, for the new people, check with the returning students, because I can go back and hunt for which date this was on my own self, but they might have it handy. But you do need to review the mechanism just for exactly what I've pointed out here, because I have a more full or lengthy explanation of it than I did last quarter. That we don't really have the time for me to repeat the whole thing now. So this bond, meaning the one on the left, is longer and weaker. Then the bond to the primary carbon, because if the bond broke on its own, a more stable carbocation would form. Now, in this acid-catalyzed ring opening, I'm sorry, yes? Wow, fantastic. November 28th and November 30th of last quarter, we talked about the cyclomercurinium and cyclobromonium ions. So Chem 12A notes are still posted from last quarter if you wanted to review that topic. Now, what I was about to say is that generally there's an alcohol or water that's used as the reagent to be added in. I'm just going to use an alcohol as my first example. So now that the ring is protonated and it's destabilized, now an alcohol would be able to attack. Why couldn't it have attacked before? Well, because it's a weak nucleophile. Remember that if we have something that's neutral like this, it's neither basic nor acidic, really. If we wanted to force the ring open, as we will do in just a moment, we need to use a base, an alkoxide. But since we just have an alcohol, it had to wait for this protonation to occur. Now that it's occurred, it can push the ring open, and notice that it's a concerted mechanism. So it has some of the feel of SN1 in the sense that we're worrying about the potential to make a carbocation. But notice that you never do make a carbocation, and there's stereochemical evidence for that, because we're going to end up with a very specific configuration to our stereocenters.
Different
Yes, since in real life the carbocation doesn't form, what you could say is that the positive charge that may develop during the reaction is still more favorable in the second than the primary. So we would be more looking at the transition state there. All right, so back to this. The important thing is that we're going to have inversion of configuration where the ether attacks. And notice that the alcohol that's formed is at the less substituted position. Then the ether forms at the more substituted position. We have one last final deprotonation step before we get to our product. Now when we come back and continue ethers, Thursday, I'll explain a little bit more about regiochemistry again. We're very low on time, so let me just briefly introduce to you the anionic version of this. So this is not base catalyzed. The previous reaction was called acid catalyzed because you get the proton back after the end of the reaction. Here the base is going to be incorporated into the product. We can have a very similar type of reaction, use the same starting material. And the key difference in this reaction is, again, before we had a weak nucleophile that could not directly force the ring open. But now we're going to use a basic alkoxide. Because this is a base that's going to approach and force the ring open, it's no longer carbocations that matter. We're not going to form one at all. It's now sterics that are going to matter. And so wherever the less sterically hindered side is, that's where the attack is going to occur. I guess let me make sure I show that clearly. So the alkoxide attacks that position, pushes the ring open. And because sterics matter more, notice now the ether is at the less substituted position. Now, in these types of reactions, nothing further would normally happen unless we switch reaction conditions, because we've used the base up, it's pushed the ring open, we've made another base that has nowhere else to go. So normally I wouldn't mix synthesis and mechanism like this, but I need to show you that we really do switch to acidic conditions. As we get later into this quarter, especially into next quarter, we have lots of functional groups that you'll learn acid mechanisms for and base mechanisms for. And because you're going to be learning so many reactions, you might end up at a point where you forget and you might mix conditions. You might use OH even though you use sulfuric acid as a reagent. You can't do that. You have to make sure that everything is compatible. So in this case, you would list the alkoxide, and then as a second step, a workup step, you would show H+. Which would finally protonate the alkoxide that was formed, and we'd end up with our product. So we're out of time, but again, we will continue with epoxides and ethers on Thursday.